Yeah, thanks, Romain. Thanks for having me here this morning. It's a little bit tough for me talking after Phil, of course, because I will mostly present simulations with kind of old school feedback, where the subgrid scale is in a much larger scale, and where much of the small scale feedback is essentially mocked up with parameter subgrid treatments. But I hope, nevertheless, to convince you that you can learn something from these calculations, nevertheless. And I particularly want to inform you about some of the recent results we got in this game. So my introductory slides to the business of why feedback is important have been shown already twice this morning, so I don't really have to bore you with those. This is also what Phil has shown. This is my version of this slide. We think that's the leading hypothesis, that on the smaller mass side of the 10 to the 12 characteristic scale, it's presumably supernova feedback that dams star formation, and for the more massive galaxies, it is AGN, or that at least is the one agent we can imagine that's doing the job. And probably from these two problems, the AGN part is probably even harder to understand, if that's the real solution, than the supernova regulation. And I think in this whole conference, we mostly concentrate on these smaller scales that here on the left of this mass peak. So we very much worked recently on cosmological simulations of galaxy formation. So we addressed the problem of simulating galaxies in large cosmological volumes. And here, we also want to work down in scale and come up with a more faithful treatment of the galaxy formation physics. So this is sort of the laundry list of things that we implemented, and that's described by this paper from Mark Vogelsberger last year in the Moving Mesh Code repo. So this is a technique that's more accurate than canonical SBH, and it's particularly well adapted, I think, to the cosmic structure formation problem, because the mesh flows along with the mass and provides an automatic adaptivity, and it has very low advection error, so it's particularly suitable for cosmic structure formation. And we try to endow this code now with galaxy formation physics so that we can simulate real galaxies. And the cooling and metal enrichment treatment is relatively straightforward, and basically, this is identical to a large degree to what, for example, in codes like Phil has described is done. The cooling rates are tabulated with as a function of the chemical mix with tables, usually, for example, computed in our case also with Claudy. We have simple self-shielding corrections and treat the enrichment also with stellar evolution models. We have, and that's maybe a difference, we also have a treatment for supermassive black hole growth. That's relying on a very simple sink particle treatment, that is, halos are endowed at the centers of their potentials with black hole particles, or sinks that can grow, that can accrete mass according to some Bondi Hoy little accretion rate prescription. And then they can also mediate energy feedback on the surroundings, and we distinguish here between quasar growth phases and also radio mode activity. That's in itself a pretty interesting field of physics, and basically it's addressing this part of feedback part on the right side of this characteristic mass scale. And then we have star formation and winds. We heard a lot about this already this morning. And here we have a differently from the very ambitious approach to basically do an ab initio treatment of the ISM embedded in cosmological simulations. We still here use a sub-resolution treatment of the interstellar medium that is now quite old, almost 10 years old. And get back to this, we also drive galactic winds according to a phenomenological description that is essentially tuned. So I will describe this in a little while. So the motivation for us why we do this explicit sub resolution treatment of star formation feedback is basically that we follow very much the goal to allow truly cosmological simulations of galaxy formation where large pieces of the universe, so I'm talking about 100 megaparsec scales, are followed where millions of galaxies form simultaneously, so that you can not only study a single galaxy and possibly try to get the physics understanding based on this one object or a couple of those, but rather look at the galaxy population as a whole in one go. We think that even though if you parameterize some aspects of the physics to the extent that you're successful in reproducing the observed galaxy population, this will inform you about the required properties of these small-scale physics to keep lambda CDM as a viable theory. And so our hope is certainly still that with this approach, we then can also constrain some aspects of the small-scale physics and identify some of the crucial physics with that. So our approach here is to introduce some physically motivated but parameterized treatment of subgrid processes. And as we heard, the subgrid process is always there. I mean, star formation, say, is fundamentally subgrid in these calculations, even in fields, and even in the next generation of field simulations in a few years or in 10 years' time, it will be the case. So we'll always have this, of course, and the question is very much where you put the scale separation between an analytic understanding, an analytic theory in a simulation on some small scales, and a fully explicit treatment of the gas dynamics and the stellar dynamics on larger scales. Now, the advantages of having such an explicit subgrid treatment, and I mean with explicit, I mean we have differential equations, partial differential equations, describe the model in a fully well-posed way, and that makes it then also resolvable in a numerical scheme. This is a point I will get back to later. So the advantage of this is that it makes the problem tractable once you have that, and you can, in fact, obtain numerically well-posed results or converged results that then will not change at some point anymore, even if you add additional resolution. It will not change because you will then not learn more about the physics on small scales because you have resolved the model down to the subgrid treatment that you put in terms of equations. So that also brings it then to the disadvantages. Of course, once you've done this, you will at some point not be able to learn or understand any of the microphysics that is subgrid that you put in by hand. That's clear enough, and Phil was also very clear about this. So we will not understand with our simulation how a wind is created. We can only understand what the wind will do to its environment. So, and basically, we would like to, once we have all this in our calculation, we get in cosmological simulations pictures like this. You know, we have lots of galaxies here, and the intergalactic gas very complicated. And we'd like to understand the properties of each of these galaxies, and that's what I'm going to talk about, how the internal structure looks like, what we can, with this particular model, learn about these objects once we, say, focus our computational resources with the very same model that we use on cosmological scales on individual objects, like, say, Milky Way galaxies for a start. So, and since this is the session about winds, I want to, which is one of the most coarse parts in our modeling, admittedly, but I want to actually not hide that coarseness and show it here how this is done. We have this standard parameterization, basically, of what the energetics of such a wind might be. There's a kinetic energy flux in the wind, and that's proportional to the to some available energy that we think comes ultimately out of the supernova energy reservoir, and you assume that there's a certain mass loading factor, that the wind mass flux is scaling with the star formation rate at some level. And essentially, there have two parameters that you don't know about. What is the velocity of the wind that's driven by the supernovae out of the galaxies, and what is the mass loading? And this is often then parameterized further. For example, you can make the assumption, motivated by observations, that the wind velocity scales with the potential well depth. So this is sort of what's found, indicated by observational observations of galactic winds. That's what we assume too. And then, you furthermore, have to assume what is then the mass loading. And you can imagine that the winds, but that's usually done, that they are energy driven, as it's said. Then you would assume for a constant wind velocity that with the available energy, the mass loading would scale as 1 over the velocity squared. So we actually assume, because we need strong feedback, in a way we assume that the maximum efficiency of the wind that you can possibly imagine is that 100% of the supernova energy, the canonical 10 to the 51 ergs per formed stellar solar per solar mass formed in stars is actually put into the kinetic energy flux of the wind. And that leaves more or less, you know, one tunable parameter, which is then the wind velocity in relation to the potential well depth. And we adopt here this parameter 3.7 for the runs that I'm now going to show you. And this is basically adjusted, this 3.7, to get the best results for things like the stellar mass halo mass relationship. And here are various plots from Mark's paper that show you, for example, the stellar halo, the stellar mass function or stellar and top. And this is the luminosity function on the top right. Here is the cosmic stellar density as a function of redshift in the cosmological simulation. This is the black hole mass stellar mass relationship here on the bottom. And we essentially tune this one parameter to get a decent fit for these basic constraints. And after that, we want to see now how far we get. And let me show you this model that's basically tuned on this small cosmological box, how it's performing now on Milky Way-sized galaxies. For this, we've taken the Aquarius simulations. These are these high-resolution dark matter runs that we have done a few years ago in the Virgo Consortium. These are simulations that concentrate their computational power in 10 to the 12 solar mass halos, you know, at the canonical Milky Way position in the cosmic web. If you zoom in, you then get this very rich substructure that also Andre already showed in his talk. If you now repeat this calculation, for example, this is just a picture with dark matter only, including the baryonic physics, and then zoom into the center, then we actually do see in the center such a stellar disk, one that looks quite nice. And now you would want to, we would like to know what the properties really are of this such a disk. And we have done 8 of these objects, since there is expected as a substantial scatter probably in the formation histories. So it doesn't help if you look at one individual zoom run of one object. You should look at multiple different initial conditions of at least the same mass range, and better yet, have a sizable spread in mass. So that wasn't the goal in this particular study. Here we indeed focus on one mass scale only, namely that of Milky Way-sized halos. And maybe I would also like to show a movie that's taking quite a while, it has already started, of the formation of such a Milky Way-sized galaxy. And you see here the stars that form in this panel, and it will, you know, it zooms over to, fades over to the gas. Here's the metallicity, and here's the temperature, and this central large panel will occasionally fade into these other quantities so that you can directly visually compare what's going on. Here, for example, you see inflow of low, basically pristine gas that's not yet metal enriched into the central region of this forming galaxy, and the yellow stuff is metal enriched gas that's also very, very hot flowing out. And I think when you look at this, you see obviously that inflow and outflows are happening simultaneously. It's a very complex gas dynamics here in this halo. So the dynamics is not only very complex in the ISM. I think we have to appreciate that the flows in the halo are extremely complex. There are inflows, outflows. I mean, has been discussed, of course, cold streams, when they are terminated, whether the disk is spun up by cold flows, yes or no, by streams. All of these issues are, of course, important, not only the ISM dynamics. And these are things that we try to address, among others, with these types of calculations. You see here that the disk has formed. And we are not yet, you know, a couple of giga years into the evolution. This movie runs for quite a while. I hope you're still not bored by it. It's, you know, it's still about a factor of 10 to the 17 or so faster than nature. So this is what we can do in on a computer. And right, so here is a stellar disk that has now formed. And if you wonder about the occasional blinking here in the center, this is largely a random artifact, because this is unfortunately from a calculation that has too few outputs. So, and we need to create about 10 frames here per dump. And in the very center of the galaxy, the interpolation scheme is not good enough to avoid this sort of flickering, because the orbits can't be interpolated accurate enough there. Yet there's also black hole here in the center, and some of the central outflows are in fact driven by occasional black hole accretion events, but that happens at very early times. Now I let this run to the very end, because you'll see something pretty curious also towards the end. This particular galaxy here is making a disk, but towards the end, it develops a second disk, kind of a very thin one, orthogonal to the primary one. That will still take a few giga-years until there. And I think one thing that you can also learn from this movie is how many dynamical times really happen. You know, you have to simulate for a long, long time to get down to redshift zero. And a lot of things are happening here between redshift 1 and 0. And I think, as it's often done, it's terminating simulations at high redshift is computational cheap. But I think you should really make the extra effort to go all the way down to redshift 0 to see what this galaxy is actually doing and what it's producing, whether it's making a galaxy that looks like the Milky Way at the end. And I think it can be very deceiving to stop at high redshift. So here you see now very clearly the metal-enriched wind coming out of the galaxy, very hot, very metal-enriched. And then finally, we are almost there, that we make our peculiar structure. So this is the stellar disk again. The disk is not tumbling quite so strongly. I'm actually turning this movie two or three times over these 13 giga-years over the horizontal axis, so that you see it occasionally from the sides. But it's not stable in orientation either. Right, so this is the dense gas. You see it's mostly coming in from the sides here because the perpendicular directions are mostly obstructed by the outflow that's coming off the disk that you see here now again. It varies from system to system. The some of them are fairly stable, but some can actually tilt and you know tumble around quite a bit. So, but most of them are relatively stable, I would say. So now I think here you see it happening, that there is this blue disk of young stars, and in the gas you saw it before, that there was a second disk developing a weak one. We see this in some systems that we have this orthogonal patterns of two different disks. Sometimes they're also regrown after mergers in different directions. Now, the disks mostly form between redshift half and 1.5 in these simulations. We have done 8 models, as I said. These are the final stellar distributions. So, and we are very happy that we finally basically get disk galaxies that look like this. This has something that has, in my own work, never really happened until very recently. And so for us, this is big progress. You know, if I would not even care if these had the wrong stellar mass. I finally get disks, you know, in a cosmology simulation. This was, since my PhD, essentially, had severe trouble for reasons that have been also discussed earlier by Phil, that we just had the wrong star formation history. High redshift is the primary reason why this didn't work. But there are lots of others. And related to suppressing the stellar mass at high redshift in particular and getting the right stellar mass is also that you then get decent rotation curves for these galaxies. So they have reasonable rotation curves because they have no dominant bulge anymore. In older generations of simulations, you would have basically something like this. This is a spheroidal system that we form among the sample. And except that in the older runs, you would have a strong bulge component that would be 4 times bigger than what's even here. So we'd have crazy rotation curves for all of these. And that's basically now essentially cured. Yeah, it is cured. It is cured by the strong wind. So we did not use such an aggressive energy. Basically, we max out available energy, and we use this scaling with the local, we use the local potential well depth, or as a proxy for that, we use the local velocity dispersion for the dark matter ejection measure. No, as I said, we don't simulate the physics that causes that, but it seems to be what there are physics that might give you that, say radiation pressure is one that would, in principle, give you such a scaling. And it's also sort of, there are indications from the observations, even though the picture is not entirely clean, that this might be actually seen. And that does the job, I think, you know. So it's indirectly an indication that this is maybe really the right scaling. Kinematically, these galaxies do now have strong disk components. Here's a decomposition in the eccentricity distribution of the stars, and you know, typically we do get above 50% of the star stellar mass in the disk component, sometimes even more than that. So these are different cases. Typically, we have a small bulge, but it's not excessively large. So there are many real galaxies that have such structure. The black holes, if you look at the star formation history, here overlaid is in green, the growth history of the black hole. You see the black hole, the central one, that grows at high redshift. There are a few periods of quasar activity. Late times, it doesn't do anything. And it also has, it's somewhat large. Here in this case, it has 10 to the 8 solar mass, but it's not unreasonable. There are systems that have such black holes, but the black holes do reduce the bulge mass slightly. So at this early time, there is feedback from our black hole. We remove it, we still get the same disk, but we get a stronger bulge. So that is also, even in such galaxies, at least in our model, part of the mix of making a successful galaxy. Sometimes here you have, for example, this is the spheroidal system. Here we have the classic case that there is a merger happening here at redshift, just be slightly above 0.5. Here's actually the first encounter. The starburst is induced by the flyby of the companion before it plunges into the main system. And then here is the second coalescence, secondary weak starburst, but a strong activity of the black hole. And after that, the merged system is actually red and dead. In this case, that's done by the black hole. here are a bunch of plots that compare various properties. On top is an interesting diagram that shows the star formation rate versus the stellar mass plane. And the points in the background, the blue and red ones, these are galaxies from Sloan. Basically, the blue and red coloring indicates the color of these galaxies. And you see very nicely the blue cloud, how this is called, actively star-forming galaxies in the red sequence. And then there are some symbols overplotted. And the Milky Way is actually, there's a pointer somewhere, I don't know, is the triangle. There's one. Thanks. Here is the Milky Way. And these are our galaxies around it. And you see they are fairly close. So in fact, they get a similar stellar mass and also have a comparable star formation rate at the present day. The Aquila comparison project that was mentioned earlier are these little squared symbols here. See, the Aquila project is interesting because it was run on the same initial conditions, okay? Well, one of the eight systems that's here, but these codes that were run, they all of them produced basic galaxies that were not matching the properties of the Milky Way. Either if the stellar mass was small enough, if the feedback was assumed to be very strong, then the present-day star formation was too low. Also, the morphology was then wrong. These were all spheroidal systems. If the feedback was weak, these systems were predicted to be disks, but they were way too massive for a halo of that given mass. Now, with this new mix of feedback, we basically managed to populate this upper left corner, where you still have enough gas left today to support ongoing star formation, but the overall stellar mass must be small enough. Here are the tracks of these systems in sort of the Mostar diagram. We're basically in this regime where that's expected. Some of the galaxies at late times go a little bit above. This might again be a problem of the AGN. Now, in terms of the formation time of the stars, then they have the right ages, and also the sizes of the galaxies come out right. So this is I think a rewarding thing that in principle lambda CDM provides, if the right angular momentum to the gas, to then set up this galaxy to the right size once you can curtail a star formation sufficiently strongly. Now, I said earlier that we do the subgrid treatment to numerically have our equations under control and allow us so that we can actually produce quantitative predictions that do not depend on numerical details, in particular on, say, the resolution that you're using. What we mean with this is that we, for example, then want to get rotation curves at different resolutions or kinematic decompositions of the disks, or here surface brightness profiles that are robust and stable if you, in this case, vary the resolution by factors of 64. And even in the star formation rate, you see that these starbursts, while not exactly reproduced in detail, qualitatively the runs are very well reproducing each other. And also in this diagram, this is the size of the galaxy, half light radius versus the stellar mass. And these three runs of the same system are very, really very close together. So that shows basically that this philosophy, I think, does work out if you have a reliable code, and then you can then really solve these partial differential equations. Of course, it has its limitations. It cannot, as I said, it cannot reveal new discoveries of the ISM. You very much get what you put in these calculations. But I would like to understand whether my calculation is reliable, which in this complex codes is a difficult thing to ensure. Here is the morphology, how these things look like, different resolution. So you get these galaxies that are approximating each other quite well. Now, the outflows are very complicated. You've seen this in the movie. We can then predict, for example, also properties of the diffuse gas. Here are metallicity profiles of the gas. There's a weak profiles. We can then also look at defects of the simulations. For example, if you look at the abundance ratios that are predicted, oxygen over iron versus iron, we see here that there is basically, compared to Milky Way stars, an underproduction of iron relative to oxygen. We think this is because we parameterized basically supernova type 1a rate slightly in a slightly wacky way. We simply use the wrong papers from the observation community. If you use other papers, you know, we get this agreement of the oxygen over iron abundance as a function of the iron. So that is, I think, a relatively minor detail, which you can then fix. We can also look at more detail, so how the halo gas is actually structured in terms of phases. And there we have, you know, cumulative gas profiles. There's a lot of information in these diagrams. I think the essential part is that that basically most of the diffuse gas actually in the halos is relatively cold. So there are strong fountain flows in our runs. The halos outside to the Wirra radius don't lose many baryons. We typically retain 50%, in some systems, over 90% of the baryons inside the Wirra radius. Yet we can achieve this very low stellar mass. So that's an interesting prediction. And these structures are consistent with models for the corona of the Milky Way. This is this gray line, at least in most of the runs, that's the case. We also have analyzed where the cooling energy is coming from in this gas, and it's actually coming out of the wind directly. So this is powering the wind energy that we put in from our feedback is reappearing as the radiation energy in our halo. One other problem we have, or a slight problem, is that the stellar disks we form are somewhat too thick. So here are in the vertical direction velocity dispersions profiles, and here's just a plain thickness profile of the stars. It's not crazily thick, and the young stars are relatively thin, but the older disks becomes relatively thickened up. So we'll have to see whether this is a consequence of the sub-resolution pressurization, but I think it will be a challenge to also explain very thin stellar disks in the future. We have, of course, a lot of missing physics, and I just want to address magnetic fields here. Here's an observation. We know that these galaxies have magnetic fields. I'm almost out of time. We have in this moving mesh code MHD solver, which is a Powell scheme with source terms. Now, this is not as good as a constraint transport, but I think it's nearly as good. At least the tests we have been able to do, they show that we get very good results with it. For example, we get the correct growth rates in the magnetorotational instability in 3D. We get good turbulence, power spectra, etc. So we haven't found really a test yet where this fails. And so we think that it should be trustworthy for cosmological runs. And so if we've done some of our simulations with magnetic fields and MHD, we find that magnetic fields build up fairly quickly from these very complicated gas flows. And we reach a final field strength that is basically not dependent at all on the initial field. So we use ideal MHD. We need to put in some initial field to let it grow. But this can be changed by 10 to 20 orders of magnitude. We still end up with the same final field. Here is then a typical galaxy that we make with magnetic fields. So this is one of our higher resolution runs. Stellar distribution, here's the gas density. This is the velocity field in the plane. Here you see a cut through the Voronoi tessellation that we're using. Here you see the individual cells. In the low density region, they are relatively large, that you can actually see those. And here the wind is coming off from the disk. And then we have here the magnetic field. That's nicely, for the most part, as smoothly oriented. And here's the pitch angle. So there's a large scale coherence of the field in the sort of temporary spiral arms, usually. And the field strength that we find is at the level of microgauss. 1 minute left. These field strengths are, and also in terms of profile, without any free parameter, are actually very good agreement with observational inferences about the field strength profiles in spiral galaxies. So we are finding this quite exciting, that the magnetic field grows to the right strengths where it starts impacting the gas dynamics. And at that point, it basically the amplification process self-terminates and stalls. And there's only a small impact of the magnetic field on the star formation properties. But it's still very interesting. And we find also interesting dynamical patterns. This pitch angle distribution, for example, shows an occasional change of over a time scale of several giga years. We can find the field can go from an anti-parallel to a parallel orientation and vice versa. And you know the orientation here in this MHD approximation of the magnetic field doesn't make a difference for the gas dynamics space. So the sign essentially is, in a sense, random, if you want. The largest difference we found for magnetic fields is that there's a small reduction of the gas mass that's, an increase in the gas that's still in the galaxies. There's additional magnetic pressure that holds it up, basically. That's the main cause. So there are some summary points. I think I have no time to read you through those. I'll leave it with that. I had some extra slides, but never mind.
Okay, so we have 10-minute questions, so not everybody will have the chance of asking a question. So I will try to ask people who didn't ask. So Claude, for example.
I have two related questions. One is, so your kinetic wind model is similar in implementation to one that Ramil Davi and collaborators have used in their simulations for many years, which I know comes from ultimately your original implementation. But my question is that they have argued that momentum-driven scalings reproduce quite well the galaxy stellar mass function over a wide range of stellar masses. So do you understand the differences between your new findings and that series of papers?
We have done another paper, so Ewald Puchwein and I, actually with SPH and Gadget Code. Very similar in principle to Oppenheimer W, and we tried there both the momentum scaling and the energy scaling, and you can over some range you get relatively similar results. And you need a relatively large range in stellar mass to see a difference, and we eventually concluded that with the energy driven scaling you really get a faint end slope that is sort of scale invariant. It's really a power law with the energy scaling, and that's why we favor that. And that's why, actually independently of this, Mark Vogelsberger has then repeated this with their Ripple code and also concluded that the energy scaling works best. So I think there's no discrepancy with their work necessarily. It's just that I probably would argue that they probably did not have enough dynamic range at the time to see that the energy scaling ultimately produces better results.
So you've partially answered my second question, which is, so these wind models, the parameters that go in these subgrid models are reminiscent of the parameters of semi-analytic models in many respects. The advantage of semi-analytic models being that it's easier, it's computationally cheaper to explore the parameter space. My understanding is that in semi-analytic models, there are degeneracies between the properties of the star formation prescription and the parameters of the best fit feedback model. So do you have a sense in these latest cosmological simulations what kind of degeneracies might exist? Or in other words, when so you find a set of parameters that matches the observations that you've compared your simulations to, how unique is that set of parameter?
Fine. So I think, I mean, I will not dispute that we do have some free parameters. There are few. I think there are fewer than in a typical semic model by far. And as you probably also know, we can't afford to do a, say, MCMC scan of the whole parameters sort of space. So at some level, this is also physical intuition, which parameters you try, you allow freedom. Most parameters are just set to the physical plausible value that you assume. And I think, you know, in the simulations that Phil presented, you know, there are lots of, you know, order of unity factors that he just, you know, picks a value that makes sense and then runs it. And that's, we do it at the same, with the same approach. We can't, and I think this is not yet at the stage that, and it's fortunately also the case that many of the results do not respond strongly to you know, mild changes of any of these parameters. So it's.
I think we're going to come back to the discussion.
Yes. Okay.
I was intrigued by your last result, that the independence of your final field on your initial field that you put in. Does that imply that your application really is of a small-scale dynamo that can act much, much quicker than the large-scale dynamo theories?
Right. I think, well, the amplification definitely is happening early and on very small scales. It's an exponential growth that's quite rapid in small scales. And in that sense, it's a dynamo process, but whether the classical theory of the small-scale dynamo, which we don't really fully resolve, applies here is another issue. Whether the complicated flows that we've seen in these, even at early times in these galaxies, driven by the feedback, the very strong shear flows that we have amplify quite strongly. So maybe we, even without what this would mean, if it's true, I mean, it is numerically certainly challenging to do this right. We have done convergence studies, and over the range we were able to test, these results are robust and seem to behave very nicely. But nevertheless, I think this has to be studied really carefully, whether this is numerically very well controlled, this early growth of the magnetic field, because there's the dissipation in the code on small scales. You know, it's very important to understand. But from so far, what we've seen is we think these results are OK. But that would then mean that the small-scale dynamo, that even without it, you have a very strong amplifier, you know, from the strong shear flows. On somewhat larger scales, that's the flows that we resolve.
I'm not sure why classical theories wouldn't have picked that up, because they do focus on the larger scale shear flows.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, whether the shear flows that you've seen in the movie, whether those are treated in analytic theories, I'm not sure. You know, those are, you know, how would you parameterize those?
Lucio? Okay. So, as you know, other groups have worked on trying to simulate realistic Milky Way-sized galaxies, and most of them actually have not used black hole feedback. Mm-hmm. And you were showing simulations with black hole feedback. So the question is, how much of the good match with the structural properties that you showed depends on using black hole feedback? For example, rotation curves. To what extent black hole feedback is crucial in giving you the right shape of the rotation curve or bulge to disk ratio or other properties?
It's not crucial, but it helps. I mean, as I said, we do get about, say, bulges that are twice as massive, say, typically. Sometimes in one or two of the systems, also the black hole at late times reduces the star formation rate quite dramatic, I would say, maybe a factor of two or so. So there are occasional periods of radio mode activity, so that start to kicking in, especially for the halos that are more massive than 10 to the 12. They were quite massive. And I think in the other group's results without black hole feedback, that you can typically see that their most massive halos typically really overproduce stars. And I think we see in our runs a tendency that they come out lower because of our black holes.
Okay.
So we have time for one last question. Gerhard, ask first.
No,
you have to use it.
Do your conditions, for instance, allow star formation in the filamentary infall in order to produce satellite galaxies? Or the conditions of temperature density in the infall?
No, they are non-Gerhard. It's also very rarely sometimes the quality works.
some gas is self-gradating enough that it becomes dense enough that we have a relatively low star formation threshold. So it can happen that there are some spray stars formed there, but it's a very subdominant process.
Okay, thank you. Thanks again for the girl. So the next speaker before the discussion is Oskar Agerts from the University of Surrey. Surrey, yeah, it sounds like Zurich. And he will discuss the interplay between star formation and stellar feedback.